how many of us struggle with getting comfortable being uncomfortable? In the case of Mark Hodulik, he questioned his ability to push himself while running track and field in college.
I have this recurring dream that I'm at track practice. I actually had a dream last night about it, where I'm literally at track practice running around and I'm not on the team, but the coach is like, man, Mark looks really good. And like, he comes over to me, and I think that I still have these questions of what could I have done? Because I never had my best race, and I never put myself in the position to really see how fast I could have gone. At the end of the day, no one cares if you're a 405 miler or a 415 miler, but I still have those questions of, wow, I let my prime pass without ever getting the most out of myself, and that's probably my biggest regret.
Also on this week's episode, we discuss learning from your failures, doing things you're scared of, and how to be intentional with your actions. And now, episode 10 of Culturation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
Are you ready? The main event of the evening.
The ideas.
It's the word that you put in.
The ability.
Can you dig it?
The talent.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
Those who influence, the entertainers, the business leaders, and the entrepreneurs, they're all right here on Culturation. And now, your host, Justin Epstein.
Welcome to Culturation. I'm your host, Justin Epstein. On this week's episode, we have the challenge curator, Mark Hodulik. Mark is the GM and operating partner in Be Boundless, where he manages the business interest for serial entrepreneur Jesse Itzler, co-owner of the Atlanta Hawks. A main focus of his role is being a challenge curator, creating endurance opportunities for like-minded individuals to invest in mind, body, and spirit. The most recent creation, 29029, involved renting a private mountain whereby participants attempted to summit 17 times until they reached the vertical height of Mount Everest. Prior to Be Boundless, Mark founded multiple nationwide event series, including BeerFit and the Wall Street Decathlon. His events have raised millions for charitable partners while garnering national press coverage from Sports Illustrated, The Wall Street Journal, and ESPN, to name a few. Before a career as a financial analyst and management consultant, he hustled payroll services at ADP door-to-door in NYC. Mark has a degree in finance from Auburn University, where he was an all-SEC academic member of the track and field team. A collegiate miler, he is quite proud of his recent 6:17 beer mile, 4 laps, 4 beers, no puking, along with 11:20 Ironman and a sub-4-hour marathon while pushing a quadriplegic. With that being said, I would like to welcome my good friend Mark Hodulik to the show. Dad, endurance athlete, entrepreneur, race creator, and innovator, thank you for being here today, man.
It's awesome to be here. Thanks for having me.
So for those that may not be familiar with you, kind of give them a little insight, you know, who you are, kind of where you're from, all that good stuff.
Yeah, look, it's a pleasure to be here. It's been an interesting road getting to this point. Grew up in Alabama. Ran track at Auburn. It was a short career, wasn't too illustrious, but proud to have competed for Auburn and a huge Auburn fan. Moved up to New York afterwards, worked in finance and the consulting industry. Always had a love of creating and doing different things. So I created a few events along the way as charity events, which turned into full-time jobs, and found my way here to Atlanta once we had kids. My wife said, we're not living in New York City with kids. And I said, I don't want to live in the suburbs. I don't want to live in the suburbs of New York. If I can't live in Tribeca, get me the hell out of here. So I have been in Atlanta for 5 years and had partnered with an amazing guy who's a friend of yours, Jesse Itzler, a year ago. And really excited about the events and lifestyle brands that we're creating together.
Nice. So you, let's kind of take it back. Were you born in Alabama?
I was born actually in Roanoke, Virginia.
Okay.
And I was born at home. So I came out pretty quick.
Okay.
A lot of people don't believe that until I show them the newspaper clipping. But yeah, I was born at home and was on the front page of the news the next day as the paramedics delivered me in my parents' bed, which doesn't sound too good as it comes out of my mouth right now. But yeah, so I was born at home and then quickly after that moved to Birmingham and grew up in Birmingham.
Okay. So growing up in Birmingham, were you into sports at a young age over there? Kind of what was your childhood like growing
sure.
up in Birmingham?
Yeah, I very fond memories of every day my dad coming home from work early and throwing the football with me, playing baseball in the front yard, dragging my sister into games. So always into sports, always watching, you know, big sporting events. I remember sitting on my dad's recliner all the time and watching sports and doing races around the house, and would make my mom and my sister hold toilet paper as the finish line. And, you know, that's from a very young age, 3, 4, 5, I'd want to run the last half mile of a run with my dad. And remember running, you know, my first mile at a race, the Montclair run in Birmingham, was a mile run that I did. And I think I was 5 and I ran it in like 10:42.
It's a solid run for a 5-year-old man.
And the motivation was I didn't want to be last. And there were some kids ahead of me and I wanted to beat them. And so from a very young age, kind of had an affinity for running, but didn't want to succumb to that. And really appreciated my parents letting me choose my sport. So I played a lot of baseball. I wasn't that great, but I made varsity as a sophomore, and I remember being like having the choice of I can ride the bench or I can run track.
Yeah.
And had already been very competitive as a freshman in track, so it was my own choice, and that kind of led me off into the running career.
So how important do you feel like it is for parents to give their kids that freedom and flexibility to make their own decisions?
Huge. I mean, we let our kids play everything right now. My boys are 7 and 6, Chase and Dylan, and it's all about sports, but they play lacrosse, they play soccer, they play baseball, they play flag football, they play basketball. Even though I kind of already know as a dad what they're probably going to be good at,
yeah.
I want them to choose themselves because I so respect my parents letting me choose myself. And also, I chose when I stopped running in college. You know, I only ran 2 years, and I never felt any pressure from them to keep running. So I think it's really important to let them try a bunch of things. Let them fail. Let them fail at sports, and don't make them focus on one thing so early on, because I think it takes the joy out of it way too soon.
No, I think that's a valid point. I mean, you don't want to have the LeVar Ball effect.
So, no, not at all. Not at all.
So baseball, you were good. I mean, sophomore varsity is, even if you're on the bench, that's an accomplishment. But
our
running
school sucked, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, no. But nonetheless,
but I appreciate
the accolades.
That. Yeah, yeah. Sure.
So at this point, running, you're looking at and like going, all right, running is my thing. It's a natural. What, did you think it was something that was like a God-given talent, or do you think it's something you work towards, or combination?
I think it's certainly a combination. Look, in grade school, every year we had like a 1 mile run on our field day, and I would win that for my grade each year, and then I held the school record. I would go to these meets with my dad where there were masters track meets, and you know, you'd have a bunch of guys I would say were washed up, but they're my age now. You know, they were 37, 38, 40, and they would run a mile, or they'd run an 800, and they were, and I would go and do those, and I, you know, track, the great thing about it is you can compare yourself to anyone because there's a standard. It's a 400 meter track. And the only different thing could be climate. But for the most part, it's very easy to compare how you compare to other 8, 10, 12, 14 year olds. And so I always knew I was pretty good. But I also worked at it. And getting into high school, my freshman year, I was highly competitive in cross country and in track. So by my sophomore year, I knew I had kind of the opportunity to compete for state titles as early as a sophomore. So
wow,
you know, it came from commitment, but there was certainly a lot of God-given talent that'll take you to a certain level.
And now, was your dad a runner?
He was, yeah.
Okay.
He was a wrestler more so than he was a runner, but you know, he came home from work and needed his 3-mile to 4-mile run every day to decompress. And then as he wanted to stretch and probably hydrate, he had me waiting with a football or baseball to play. So
do you think watching him growing up kind of was a big indicator or like a push for you to want to be involved actively in sports?
Sure. I mean, look, without a doubt, I mean, both of my parents are really hands-on, but my dad obviously playing sports with me every day. I always wanted to be active and be outside. And I think that's one of the challenges for parents right now is that you feel like you have to have so many structured activities after school for them. And they just need free play. And my free play was just being outside playing sports with my dad, with other neighborhood kids. And so I think that certainly shaped my view on being active from a very early age. I saw my parents taking care of themselves. They went for walks all the time together. Yeah. They still do. Every day they go for a long walk
together.
That's
awesome.
So I think that's something that was ingrained in me from an early age was being healthy and being active.
Do you think kids these days are getting outside as much as they used to? I mean, it seems like, you know, growing up, we'd be in the streets, the neighborhood kids, like all of us playing, like whether it be hockey or basketball or just getting into trouble running outside. And these days you see kids like trading stock options on iPads at like 3 years old.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's funny to see the apps that I find downloaded on my phone, whether it be, you know, my kids are into sports. So it's guess the college logo is one. Right. And
that's,
you have to guess what logo it is as it comes up and stuff like that. But no, kids are much more technologically inclined, which is great. The things my kids can do in first and second grade compared to what I was doing back then is crazy.
Yeah.
At the same time, I took my BMX bike at 7 and 8 years old and would ride you know, outside of the neighborhood to a convenience store with money that I earned from a lemonade stand and, you know, go buy a soda or whatever it was. It makes me sound so old, but like, I wouldn't let my kids go and do that now.
Yeah, no, I think about the stuff that I did. I'm like, there's no way.
And I think the world's actually, for a lot of things, it's actually safer in a lot of respects, but it just feels like things have changed so much where you're almost more overbearing with your kids because you're so worried about what could happen to them, which is, it comes from a good place.
Yeah.
But it is completely changed. I mean, I just remember going out in my front yard and like digging a hole. Like, I don't remember what we were digging for, like what the purpose was, or like building a tree fort, you know, or going down by the creek. And, you know, we lived in a nice neighborhood, but there was a decent amount of woods around us. I grew up in Alabama, so it wasn't like I grew up, you know, in Queens, right? So we did have a lot of outdoor land to play on.
Okay.
But I do feel like that's changed, and the perspective has changed a lot too.
So now in high school, you start pursuing track, right? More active, kind of put baseball to the side.
Yes.
How do you kind of advance and grow in high school from a track standpoint? Are you winning championships? Are you going to states? What's kind of happening?
Yeah, sure. So baseball was kind of a foregone conclusion. But the transition to track going into my sophomore year, you're able to really compare across all divisions. I was in the largest division in the state, so the most competitive division. But Alabama's still a small state. So I started comparing myself to kids out of state. And it was a real driving factor. You know, a lot of the work that you get, or a lot of the benefit that you get out of track, is work you put in during the summer. And those were runs that I took with my dad. And I always fondly remember going to this corporate office park, you know, a couple of miles from our house, and running on the grass there with my dad. And putting in the work and kind of seeing that pretty early on. I think I won my first state championships when I was a junior.
Okay.
That was in the 1600 and then the 3200, so the mile and 2 mile as a junior. And then my senior year, I won the cross-country state championships, and I won the mile and 2 mile again.
Wow.
So, you know, it was it built to a point, and not every race is a great race. And that's one of the hard things, is that, you know, you kind of see it in the world of sports. You get built up pretty quickly, and the second you have a bad race, they had rankings in the state by this newsletter.
Yeah.
And my senior year, you know, I had won like the first 5 cross-country races of the season. I had a bad race and came in like 25th, which was like just unheard of. Like, the worst I should come in was 2nd or 3rd. And they dropped me to like, you know, 10th in the rankings. It was like, what's wrong with Mark Hodelin type thing?
Even though you won like 3 state championships.
And it's on a, such a small scale, but you kind of, I realized that like a pretty early on age at 17 years old, kind of how to handle adversity in that expectations.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was an interesting transition to college, from where you go from winning every race or close to winning every race to just getting absolutely worked in the SEC. So it's a completely different world.
Do you think not having some good races early on, like you said, and having that adversity or those things where people are, you know, putting a microscope on you, kind of helped you kind of prepare for real life in a lot of ways?
Sure. I mean, without a doubt, you realize that the failures are actually what you learn from, that you don't gain a lot from winning.
Yeah.
Sure, it feels good. It's a recognition of the hard work that you put in, that you've been able to execute, but there's no growth that happens from a lot of success. The growth happens from when you fall down, when you have a bad race, when you have to question yourself. It comes from those challenges that you face and how you overcome them. So without a doubt, it helped. And I would say later on in life, I'm certainly able to reflect on a lot of those experiences and see, you know, the growth that I've had from them.
So when you were, let's just take the mile in high school, when you're winning state, what are you running a mile at this point?
So my best mile time in high school was 4:21.
That's ridiculous.
Which, to put in perspective, like, look, it was great for Alabama.
It's pretty insane.
I'm always humble putting in perspective that I was the state champion and the fastest miler in Alabama. And if you look to California, I would have been like the 25th fastest, right?
What were people running in California a mile?
So like, to be in the top 10, you had to run less than 4:15. And like, your top 3 guys were running 4:04 to 4:06. And that is light years difference than 4:21. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't understand, but to put it in perspective, I mean, it's probably the difference between someone's best being a 7-minute mile and a 5:30 mile is a difference from going to 4:20 to 4:05. It is light years difference.
I mean, that's an insane speed for a mile.
Sure.
Yeah. Wow. All right. So you go through, you win a bunch of state championships. You're feeling pretty good at this point.
Sure.
And then next decision is, okay, I got to pick a college, right?
Right.
And being an athlete, were you looking at a college from a education standpoint? What was the best sports standpoint?
Great question.
A combination?
Yeah, going back, and I was just talking with my parents about this over Thanksgiving in the Iron Bowl, because I was actually wanting to go somewhat to Alabama. I had a great track program at the time. And when they had to say great, they had a great middle distance and distance program, where Auburn was really known for sprinters and field events. And I was a middle distance to a distance runner. So I was in state thinking, well, Alabama would be great, great to go to, even though I grew up kind of loathing Alabama from a football perspective. And so I was looking at schools. Brown, Ivy League, started recruiting me pretty hard. I had really good grades. Not that I tried really hard.
Yeah.
I kind of did the minimum to have a 3.5, which was like with honors. So that's probably not the best way to approach education, but I did like the least amount I could do to have like a high grade point average.
Still strategic though.
That was right. It was time management, as I would like to say. And so I was like considering Brown. I was considering actually going out west for a bit. And then very late in the game, the Auburn coach had asked me to come for a visit. And, you know, for everything you hear about official visits from like a high school football player, top recruiter, basketball player,
yeah,
the track recruiting is hysterical. You know, it's like they give some dorky guy on the track team like $40 and they're like, hey, take Mark out. You know, like we had some like terrible meal. You know, there were no girls involved. There was no party involved, you know. It's really funny to think back to about some of the ways that I entertained recruits when they came.
Yeah.
But I went to Auburn and it just felt like home, honestly. And it just had such a good feeling. So the reason for not choosing some of the smaller schools was atmosphere. It was, I wanted to put myself in that arena where I was against the best athletes and see how I would react. And the results were not what I wanted, but I'm still glad that I made that choice.
So when you get to Auburn, right, how's your first year? Are you performing well?
Sure.
Are you, like, where do you stand as far as other athletes in your
school? So you report pretty early when you're on a sport at a major college. So school at that time, we were on quarters. We didn't start until September. And I had a report like second week of August. So there's no one on campus. The week before I report, meet all my new teammates, my roommates. So excited. I'm on a long run on a trail and I step in a hole and do a high ankle sprain. So I show up first day, first meeting all my teammates in an ankle boot, crutches. Wow, yeah. So the first year was tough just from a perspective of wanting to bond with my track teammates, wanting to train with them.
Did you redshirt first year?
So it's a great question. I did. Okay. I did for the cross country season. I laugh about that because it's like, as a track and field athlete, you kind of put things in perspective of like, you're probably not going to use your fifth year of eligibility. like you're not going to be that important to a program, but I did do a red shirt. And that was through the cross country season. So you have different seasons. You basically have cross country, indoor track and outdoor track. So I spent my time in the pool. Auburn actually had won like 3 national titles in swimming. Swimmers were like the shit, excuse my language, on campus. I spent my time doing non-weight bearing running in the pool a lot. I was on the bike a lot, trying to stay in shape and rehab my ankle. So cross country season was tough, but then indoor and outdoor track I actually ran and you know, had an okay season.
But what's okay to you? Because when you're winning state championships, you're like, it's okay.
Yeah. You know, okay for me was, first of all, you have 12 middle distance runners. Only the top 3 would actually go to a meet. So for most meets, we had smaller meets where the whole team could go. But the larger meets, you actually had to make the travel squad. So the school, you know, we went to a meet in Arizona. They're not going to put everybody on a plane and fly them to Arizona. So I was actually able through the track season to make the travel squad, which was a big deal.
Big deal, yeah.
Auburn wasn't that competitive, just being honest. So even though I was making the travel squad, I was going to meets and getting worked. I mean, running personal best, so 4:15, 4:16, 4:17 mile equivalent. We ran the 1500. So, you know, running a 4-minute 1500 or a 3:59 or a 4:01, you basically add 18 to 20 seconds onto that. I was running personal best, but I'm going into the last lap of a race 5 seconds behind the leaders and then finishing 15 to 20 seconds behind them.
Wow.
So the last lap of a race was their fastest. They're running like a 55 second quarter mile. I'm running like a 70 because I'm dying. And to lose 15 seconds in a lap is just demoralizing. You know, they're basically jockeying for position for 3 laps and doing an all-out sprint the last lap, where I'm doing an all-out sprint the first 3 laps just to try to be there for the 4th lap. So it was eye-awakening to just see the chasm between myself and where a lot of the rest of the SEC was in terms of the top level talent.
Do you think if you went to a different program that would have made a difference, or these were just kids that were talent wise just exceptional?
Mentally, it would have. And I think that's things that I learned much later on in life. I went into those meets comparing myself to guys in the SEC that I were competing against ran for the U.S. Olympic team, right? Yeah. Tim Brough, Seneca Lassiter, I mean, names that were like track geeks would know who they were, but they literally represented the United States, and I'm on the track with them. How can I compare myself to them? But I was, and I think I went into those meets kind of knowing I was going to get worked rather than running just to the best of my ability. And that was probably the hardest thing, was I didn't run my race, I ran their race. Where in high school, I dictated the race.
Yeah.
I went in there knowing what I was capable of, knowing that if I wanted it to come down to a sprint, I'd outsprint the guy next to me, or knowing that if I wanted to really push the pace and make sure that a really good sprinter couldn't outsprint me at the end, I would do that. In college, I ran to what everyone else was doing, and I ran scared. And later on in life, as I've approached endurance events, you go in there with the mentality of, this is my plan, and no matter what else happens, no one's going to take me off of my plan. That doesn't mean you're not competitive,
yeah,
but it means I will always want to get to myself where I get to a position where when it really hurts, I want to lean in. In college, I was scared of what would happen when it hurt. And a lot of times, like, it hurt really quickly,
yeah.
Because I was running at a pace that I shouldn't have been, because I was trying to compete with guys that were just out of my league at the time.
So did you run all 4 years of college?
I didn't, no. I ran 2 years.
Okay.
And, you know, going into my junior year, that summer was a tough place because, you know, you're supposed to be running 70 to 80 miles a week getting ready for the next season. And it just wasn't there.
Yeah.
You know, I just was at a place where probably I let myself feel defeated. And yeah, it's tough to admit that. I think for a long time I beat myself up about it. Now I'm able to honestly admit that I just felt outclassed. And it was almost a little bit of like, what's the point? And I couldn't admit that to myself at the time. And, you know, I'd had stress fractures and I had injuries that came from increased mileage. But those are just excuses. Everybody else had those as well and found a way to work through them and be competitive. I think I knew deep down in my heart that I wasn't willing to put in the work and the time to get to that next level, because a lot of, I feel like, what separated me from just the upper third was just the ability to suck it up and hurt,
yeah,
and get comfortable being uncomfortable. And that's something that I wanted to go to football games. I wanted to drink. I wanted to try to date and have a life.
To be normal,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. And I wanted, you know, look, Auburn's a really fun, big football school. And I wanted to enjoy those things more than I wanted to sacrifice to get to that next level.
I mean, for a young person, though, right, in college, especially when you're, like, discovering yourself in a lot of ways and what you want to do, you know, looking back at it, do you look at it as, like, that was a pretty mature decision to make? Because a lot of people, based on ego and just not wanting to look like it was a failure, things like that, will continue doing things, whether it be sports, their job, a relationship that's not working, just to stay at them for the comfort.
Sure. I don't know that I look back at it as a mature decision. It's a really intellectual way to look at it, and I appreciate that. But I think that's giving me too much credit at the time. I think that it was the right decision looking back.
Yeah.
But I'm not happy with how I made the decision or how it was even communicated to my coach and to my teammates. Not like I was some star athlete that needed to come, but I felt like a lot of my junior year, I kind of held on to this hope. I have this recurring dream that I'm at track practice. I actually had a dream last night about it, where I'm literally at track practice running around and I'm not on the team, but the coach is like, man, Mark looks really good. And like, he comes over to me, and I think that I still have these questions of what could I have done? Because I'd never had my best race, and I never put myself in the position to really see how fast I could have gone. At the end of the day, no one cares if you're a 405 miler or a 415 miler.
Yeah.
But I still have those questions of, wow, I let my prime pass without ever getting the most out of myself. And that's probably my biggest regret.
Got it. So at this point, you stop running, right? How much of a role is education now? Are you starting to look at careers, degrees, or are you just kind of still not sure what you want to do? I mean, it's tough being an athlete in college,
sure,
right? I mean, you're dedicating your life to a sport.
Without
and then when you do something competitively your whole life, and I only say this because I came from playing collegiate soccer and then I stopped after year one.
Sure.
You almost feel lost because, A, you have free time.
Without a doubt.
And you're like, let me just take advantage of this. Like, I'm not used to this. But B, then you don't really know. Like, I know I had a challenge trying to figure out what the next step was.
Yeah, I mean, look, I found ways to fill my time.
Yeah.
The way I always looked at college was, it was teaching me how to learn. So I didn't necessarily focus on a career, to be honest. I just thought of each class was teaching me a different way of learning new things. And that, you know, I was kind of putting that in the back of my mind. But I really looked to almost do the complete opposite of free up my schedule as much as possible. So I scheduled all of my classes and I took 18 hours for a few semesters, which was a lot. And I did 9 hours on Tuesday and 9 hours on Thursday. And then I started working at, I love playing golf and I just didn't have time to do it when I was running track. So I started working at a really nice golf club and I would work from 5 a.m. to noon and then play golf in the afternoon and have my buddies out there and play golf. And this is going to sound really vain, but being a runner, I mean, when I ran, I'm 5'9", I'd like to say, I will round up from 5'8". I'm 5'9", you know, 155. When I ran in college, I was 128 to 125 pounds, right? And so there was this thing of, I didn't look like I was in college. You know, I was tiny. There got to be this thing of, I want to put on weight. So I started lifting. And got to be friends with guys, you know, who were, you know, this sounds funny, but who were cheerleaders at Auburn. They have to be actually be really strong to lift the women over their heads. And like they're hanging out with good looking girls. And one of my roommates at the time was a cheerleader and would lift with him every day and really just wanted to put on muscle. Like it went from running every day and staying lean and really skinny to me wanting to get big. And I'm using air quotes because me getting big was not big, but it was literally just putting on muscle became honestly a really big focus for a while. And it was a good outlet because I was used to working out, but I didn't want to be running necessarily anymore. So I would say I filled my time with kind of lifting weights, staying in shape that way, playing golf and, you know, having that job. Yeah. And honestly, just being in college, you don't realize how much free time you have.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's funny to think back things we did to fill our free time. But it was just a lot of being selfish with my time.
But, you know, with athletes, I feel like especially when you're used to coming up, right, you're on such a structured lifestyle, right? It's like you got to run at this time, work out at this time.
Yes.
Like, do you feel like having that regimented lifestyle allowed you to compartmentalize and have a time management skill that a lot of people may not have or lack? Like just even talking about how you took your classes, I have 9 hours here, 9 hours there, gives me time for golf. You kind of already planned out,
right?
Which I feel like a lot of college kids would not do.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, I've always focused on what I want to be doing and figure out a way to make sure I can get to do those things. So certainly having the discipline with track, like I knew I had to do a morning run and I had afternoon practice. And those were bookends of my day. And so during that time, if I wanted to do other things, I really had to focus on how to find out the best way to do those things. Look, if you wanted to drink at night, you had to figure out how can I do my morning run and get to class and not have a terrible hangover.
Yeah.
You know, so like you literally had to be like, well, I'm going to drink earlier in the night. You know, I'm going to drink coconut water. I don't think we drink coconut water at the time. I'm going to drink water.
Yeah.
I'm going to have an Advil next to my bed like you planned. And so when I stopped running, I knew that I wanted to be doing certain things. So I think that structure helped. And now in life, I want to throw the football with my kids.
Yeah.
So that means planning my day and knowing that at night, I'm not going to be going out a lot at night because I'm going to work at night because I want there to be a block between 5 and 7 that I'm spending with my kids, but I'm building a business and that needs a lot of time and energy.
Yeah.
And so I think it did teach me very early on about time management, not necessarily in the sense of, you know, a perfect structure, but how to take advantage of, or how to put a schedule together to take advantage of the things that I really wanted to do.
Yeah.
So it helped me hone in on and have a laser focus on a priority of how to spend my time.
You know, I think that's an interesting way you broke it down is that a lot of people are always like, I got to get shit done. It's like a chore, right? And then if you can fit in the other stuff, your approach is, I know what I want to get done. I know what kind of holds the highest priority. What do I need to do to get around that to ensure that that is always going to be completed? Which I think if more people did that in life in general, I mean, it's going to change the way I think actually, because a lot of times running businesses, things like that, you just have so much shit you got to get done. But I think when you're like, these are my non-negotiables.
Without doubt.
You're going to really maximize the time to complete the things that are kind of holding up those things from being executed.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's finding time for yourself. And I realized pretty early on that I need to have a few things to keep me happy. And I need time with my kids. I need time with my wife. And like, I need a little bit of time to myself. And that's working out for the most part.
Yeah.
And so every day it's crazy. But if you look in my calendar, I literally have a block that says kids. And there's some days where I have to take that out, you know, life and business and other things happen, but it's literally in my calendar. So it's a reminder of like, okay, if I'm able to break away, I know this is time I want to spend and things I want to do. And it's not the same amount of time every day.
Yeah.
Travel comes up and other things, but it's not to be so regimented, and it's almost geeky to say that I actually have a calendar block there, but I think it's being real intentional about those things that you really want to do. And it's been a point with my wife where we've had to discuss, like, she needs to be more selfish.
Yeah.
She needs to make sure that she gets those things done for herself. So you don't regret people at the end of the day or end of the week, because there's so many demands on her, taking care of the kids and running the home and other things, that I think you can easily get distracted. And at the end of the day, you're like, oh, I didn't get my workout in, or I didn't go to yoga, or I didn't do these certain things that I wanted to do. And you're frustrated. And so I found the way I don't get frustrated is by making sure that I schedule those things and then take care of all my other shit to make sure that those get done.
I mean, I think you nailed it with one word: intentional.
Exactly.
Like, you know, that to me sums it up.
Sure.
So now you are experiencing college, you're having fun, you're filling the times with the things you want to do. You graduate. What's the next step?
Honestly, the next step was, for whatever reason, I wanted to go to New York. You know, my dad grew up in New Jersey. We went to New York City and New Jersey every year. I have a lot of family who lives on the Jersey Shore. And, you know, every time I went in New York, I just felt an energy and a vibe. I graduated in 02. So right after 9/11, it was a scary time. Job market wasn't great. I was a finance major and an accounting minor, and I wanted a job on Wall Street. And it was tough to get a job in New York when you're based and no one was coming to Auburn to recruit Wall Street. They went to Ivy League schools. They went to Stanford. No one was coming to Auburn looking, you know, for the next hedge fund manager. And so once again, to be really intentional, I was like, well, look, what's the best way I can use my network? We had a family friend who had a financial services firm in Birmingham. I didn't want to live in Birmingham, but it was an entree into the industry. And he had a really cool firm where a lot of money managers came in from New York City. And every time they came into the office, it was an opportunity for me to network and sit in a meeting. And he knew my goal was to go to New York. And so it was a great way to build relationships. And finally, one day, I remember my dad saying, you know, the only way you're going to get a job in New York is to move to New York.
Yeah.
And one of my track teammates lived in the city, was kind enough to let me come up and live with him. And I hustled, honestly. I left my job after a year, and it's a phenomenal job, and it's still a phenomenal firm, and I could have done some great things there, but it was in Birmingham. That's not where I wanted to be. So I left that job as an analyst and moved up to the city without a job, and worked at a catering company. I created a little t-shirt brand, and we sold t-shirts. We literally drank from like 8 till midnight, and then to get our courage up, and then we'd walk around the streets of Manhattan as people came out of clubs between like 12 and 4 and sell them t-shirts. And I interviewed, and I had a really good network to go from, but I really wanted to work for a fund of funds or a hedge fund. And I just didn't have the background necessarily to justify the kind of job I wanted. I didn't have the financial acumen, honestly. And I really was pigeonholed on what I wanted to do. I had a narrow focus on it. And so I took a job selling payroll for ADP.
Okay.
And it was very smart in hindsight, because I wanted a job that allowed me to be out of the office and interview. I didn't want to sell payroll door to door. But it was an awesome way to also get, you know, Jesse, who we both know well, my business partner, will say, you got to get comfortable being uncomfortable. Knocking on doors in Manhattan with a Southern accent and literally them being like, you're my third ADP payroll representative in the last month. I don't give a damn who you are, what you're selling. I don't want it.
Yeah.
You very quickly get to overcome objection and embarrassment. You don't care about being embarrassed because you're finally like, well, who the hell cares? Like 50 people said no to me today. Someone's going to say yes. So I sold payroll door to door for ADP while interviewing for other jobs for, I guess it was probably 6 months. Okay. I did that 5 to 6 months. I sold for ADP until I got a job at a consulting firm, which was Towers Perrin at the time, a management consulting firm.
Okay. So if you didn't take the job, I kind of want to jump back a little bit. You took the job in Alabama, right? To just kind of get your foot in the door. If you felt like you just went straight to New York versus doing that, do you think the results would have been the same?
Great question. I've never thought about that. I honestly don't know if they would have been the same. I'm not sure that I was mature enough to handle the rejection yet. And things had come pretty easy to me. Look, my parents paid for my college. I was an okay athlete, had a great experience in college. I needed a year of toughening up a little bit and living at home was a tough pill to swallow.
Yeah.
You know, dating girls and being like, I live at my parents' house. Like, screaming that up. Wasn't a good look, right? And I think I needed that year of kind of like humble pie.
Yeah.
And it made me want New York a lot more. It would have been very easy for me to go up to New York after college and live with my same buddy. I don't think I would have been near as successful because I think I would have gotten very frustrated quickly and not been willing to put in the work. Being a year in Birmingham and feeling the pull every day, by the end of that year, I was ready to do anything. I didn't mind catering a party.
Yeah.
I didn't mind selling t-shirts late at night. I didn't mind selling payroll door to door because I knew there was an end goal that I wanted much more than I wanted probably right when I graduated college.
Yeah. So now you're at this consultancy firm, finally get a job after 6 months of doing payroll sales. Kind of how long are you there? How does that experience transpire? Like,
look, it was a great, great opportunity. It was not necessarily where I thought I would be. It was management consulting focused on executive compensation, right? Doesn't that sound sexy? And so, but what it is, it had a large financial bent to it. It was taking a company and figuring out what key metrics they needed to focus on and how to align the long-term success of the company with their executives' pay to make sure that an executive was going after those things that were going to drive long-term shareholder value and make sure that his pay was tied to those things and not in an egregious way. And so we were never the ones saying, we're almost always, you know, fighting for the CEOs and executives to make more money. Not necessarily fighting for them to make more money, but comparing them to their peer set mm-hmm. and figuring out. So it was an interesting opportunity. People I worked with were fantastic, honestly. They really showed me how to conduct business. So from writing proposals to creating pitch books, to presenting to board of directors. I mean, I got to sit in board meetings of Fortune 100 companies with senior partners and kind of seeing the way executives operated. And that, you know, sometimes we worked for the board, sometimes we worked for the executive team. There was never an objective to get anyone more money or less money, but understanding the way a business worked in a big business was fantastic. Yeah. So I got to see a lot of behind the scenes things by working for some of the top companies in America as a consultant that I would never otherwise would have seen because I would have just been stuck in corporate America somewhere.
Nice. So now you're there, you get this a good experience. What's kind of the next move in the career?
Sure. So, I mean, look, I progressed rather quickly because I was always willing to ask. I wasn't the best analyst, but then I became a senior analyst and then I became a consultant. Then I became a senior consultant rather quickly because I wanted to work with the best partners and I was very strategic about my relationships within the firm. Some people saw through that, which is funny. Some people knew that I didn't have the analytical skills, but I always kind of went back on the side of I had the people skills and someone else can do the analytical stuff, right? And that lasted for a bit. And then there was a point where a senior partner kind of sat me down and was like, look, if you want to make partner, you need to nail like these six things. And I was like, God, I don't want to do any of that. Like, I'm good with like two of those.
Yeah.
But I don't want to do those other four. And I wasn't willing to make that commitment. And during that period, a buddy of mine, we had a little bit of a debate at a bar one night amongst who was the best athlete. And a handful of our other friends joined in. One was a college soccer player. One was a lacrosse player. One was a swimmer. One was a baseball player. And, you know, if we'd had a basketball player, the argument would have been over with because a basketball player would have been the best athlete. But yeah. we didn't have that. And so long and short of it is we decided, hey, let's go find out and put 10 events together, went to East River Park and did those 10 events. I scored it on, you know, my IBM ThinkPad, you know, corporate computer, wrote some Excel macros and had a scoring sheet. And we went through and did, you know, 10 everyday events and decided we'd crowned the best athlete. I was the only guy that didn't work on Wall Street. And so we said, we crowned Wall Street's best athlete. And that event became known as the decathlon and then became the Wall Street decathlon. And since I was bought out of my stake, it's now called something different. I think the D10 or something like that. But it became an event that was a fundraising event in New York City. And that continued to grow while I was being a consultant.
Okay, so you're doing both at the same time?
Yes, doing both at the same time.
Okay, so now you're getting your love for sports back, analytics are kind of tying into it, but in a different way than you would initially hope with the consultancy job. And when you first start this on Wall Street, how many people run the first race?
So the first time we opened it to the public, we had 18 people do it.
Okay.
But we had a ringer. We had a guy who had a big Wall Street backer. And kind of our hook was the first year we did it, you know, I think tickets were like $200, $150. We had no idea what we were doing from an event management standpoint. But we were very thoughtful about the events. And we got some great competitors just from our network. And they were all former college athletes. And some of them real stud athletes. I mean, all American athletes. And, you know, it's like how many pull-ups you can do. A lot of it was like the CrossFit games before CrossFit. How many dips you can do, how fast you run a 40-yard dash, how far you throw a football. And we had all these metrics that we put in. And so we decided we should benefit a cause. And at that time, Livestrong and Lance Armstrong was all the rage. I mean, this is 2006 or 7. So Livestrong was a great charity to benefit. And we had a guy say, hey, for every pull-up my analyst does after like pull-up 24, I'll donate like $10,000. So lo and behold, this guy does like 30. He himself raises 60 grand. We have 18 people in an event raise over $100,000 for Lance Armstrong Livestrong Foundation. And it all went directly to the charity. And we're like, wow, we may have a model here. And we called it charity betting, whereby you would put amount of money down. And if, let's say your goal was 10 pull-ups, you would go to your donors and say, hey, look, if I do 10 pull-ups or more, your donation is going to go up. If I do 10 pull-ups or less, your donation is going to go down. So it was performance-based fundraising.
Yeah. Look,
it was natural for me to create it because I'm working as a management consultant around performance-based pay for executives. So it was taking a lot of stuff from work and saying, hey, look, why does everyone just give a flat dollar amount? If you do more, shouldn't you donate more? If you have a goal to run a marathon, it's not just finishing. 98% of people who start a marathon finish. Shouldn't you donate more if you beat your goal, if you run faster? And so we started aligning donations and the amount raised with performance. And so that pretty quickly catapulted and got some steam to where the second year we only had, you know, 40 something competitors, but we raised $500,000.
Wow.
And then by the third year, you know, we'd sold the event out, which at that time our cap was around 100 people, but we'd raised over $1 million. And by that time we'd partner with Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center.
Okay.
So we had a big fundraising machine with still a small amount of people. So it was an interesting model.
I mean, that's 100 people, $1 million.
Yes.
That's insane.
Yeah. And we got to the point where when I left in 2015, we were doing like 1.7 million with 125-ish people.
And where did they run through Wall Street? Like right down Wall Street?
So no, we were at Columbia University.
Okay.
Then we went to St. John's University. And, you know, because it was all centered around it. You know, it had a 400 meter dash,
yeah,
and 800 meter run. Those are the bookend events. You had a football throw. So we needed a track, but we'd bring out all rogue equipment. You know, you had these pull-up sets and dip sets, and we had a bench press. So it was kind of NFL Combine meets a track and field event meets the CrossFit Games.
Gotcha.
In a day.
So how competitive were people?
You know, it was highly competitive. That was actually one of the barriers to growth, was that it was great for press and media coverage to crown Wall Street's best athlete. There were Business Insider stories of like, look at 50 ripped Wall Street guys. You know,
I just saw one like 2 weeks ago. I was talking about it.
It's nuts. And, you know, they'd get like 1 million views. But people didn't want to compete unless they could win.
Yeah.
It was only about being Wall Street's best athlete, not being Wall Street's second or third or fourth best athlete. So you had guys that were insane athletes, could do 25 dead hang pull-ups, could run a 4.5 40. I mean, were just studs, but they would look at the results and be like, oh, my coworkers are going to make fun of me if I come in seventh in pull-ups. Meanwhile, these coworkers are eating like huge hoagies and, you know, gravy covered fries and not even working out. But in Wall Street, there's a mentality of just don't get embarrassed. Don't be the butt of jokes, rather than be the guy who goes and fundraises a ton for charity and is really testing himself athletically. It's more like, just don't fail, because I don't want to be the butt of these jokes.
And that's just the industry's
mindset. Yeah, I mean,
mindset.
It was really a huge barrier to our growth, was you could do the whole event in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Literally, the whole event in 20 minutes. Now, it took 4 hours to run everyone through it, or 5 hours, but you're just doing one set of pull-ups till you can't do anymore. One set of dips till you can't do anymore. Throwing a football 3 times, see how far it goes. It's not inherently hard. So the accomplishment of doing the event didn't necessarily translate, but people devoted 6-9 months to the disciplines to get as good as they could get at them. And so it was awesome to see the athletes that would come out who were All-American football players.
Yeah.
I mean, All-Americans in college coming out and destroying things out there. But it was a barrier to growth because people only wanted to do it if they thought they could win. There was such a narrative around winning that the broader cause of doing something for pediatric cancer research, where 100% of the dollars raised went to the beneficiary, wasn't the lead story. The lead story was always, how many pull-ups can you do?
Yeah.
Or how are you going to compare to someone else?
So this race was your first foray into like creation of ideas for events and logistics and
yes.
kind of really this kind of put a taste in your mouth. Like, I want to do more of this.
Yeah, without a doubt. It was awesome to take something from an idea in your head to executing to then refining and perfecting. And so it really fed off a creative bone I had that I didn't know that I really had. I'd always had a desire to hustle and be doing, you know, something on the side, but to have it actually see it take shape and others be drawn to it and then create a brand. That's probably the thing that was most valuable to me, was going for a run in Central Park and seeing someone wear our hat. We
yeah.
didn't sell our merchandise. You know, it was one of our 150 competitors, 125 people, but that was really powerful to see that. And I really like going through the creative process with those firms that we worked with, the web design firms, the logo brand creation firms. I loved being part of that process because it utilized a whole different part of my brain that I wasn't getting out of my day job.
Gotcha. So now you're with a consultancy. You eventually leave that job.
Sure.
You eventually, like you say, exited out of the decathlon.
Yep.
Where do you kind of go from here?
Yeah. So leaving the consultancy was interesting. I was kind of nervous about it, and I don't know why. I didn't tell people I was doing it because we weren't allowed to moonlight, and I
yeah.
was just very nervous that I would be breaking corporate regulations until the Wall Street Journal named me donor of the day. And it was literally like my face and my business partner's face in the Wall Street Journal. And like all these partners are like congratulating me. This is amazing. Why didn't you tell me about this? And it was like they didn't realize that this was a business that we were running too. Like, it was a great fundraising event. But pretty quickly I realized like this needs to devote my full-time attention. So we had sold sponsorships. We sold a big 3-year deal to a bank to be the title sponsor. I was like, look, to manage this relationship, I can't properly do both. And so that's why I left. Did that for a few years and had an idea in the back of my head of, at the end of every track season, you have to understand that track runners are not right in the head, most distance runners. I won't throw sprinters into that mix. They tend to be a little bit cooler, more level-headed, but you know, you're kind of a little bit the outcast. You run a long distance a lot for pain. So at the end of every track season, you have an outlet for that, and it was drinking a lot of beer and running a mile. And we did, which a lot of people didn't know about until 2015. Before 2015, it was really an underground event called the Beer Mile. And the Beer Mile is when you drink a beer and run a lap, and you do that 4 times. So it's 4 beers and 4 laps. And there's a couple other rules around it, but at the end of the day, you got to drink 5% alcohol beer. It's got to be out of a can. You can't shotgun, you can't funnel, and you can't throw up. Those are basically the rules.
Okay.
And we did that at the end of every track season. And, you know, we were idiots about it because we would drink like a 6-pack first and then do it. Some guys did it naked. You know, it was a real free-for-all. It was fun. And I always had this idea in the back of my head that, like, I think more people would want to do this, because whenever people would ask me about my track career, say, you know, what was your most memorable thing about your all-in track career? And I was like, oh, you know, I broke 7 in the Beer Mile. They'd be like, what? That's an event? I'm like, no, it's just the end of every track season. Like, I broke 7. They're like, what's that? And I was like, I could drink 4 beers and run a mile in under 7 minutes. And they were really impressed by that. And so I always thought, well, wow, if people are impressed by that, maybe they want to try it themselves. So I was living here in Atlanta and went to Monday Night Brewery, which is a brewery that I liked and was around the corner from me in Midtown, and went to one of their owners and was like, look, I got an idea for you for an event. You supply the beer, I'll do all the logistics, and we'll get a marketing partner and we'll put it all together and see if it works. And we initially called it the Monday Night Mile. And it was literally just a fail fast business test. That's all it was. It was, my friends and I are going to put it on. We're going to get free beer. We're going to sell a limited amount of tickets and just see how it goes. And look, it was a shit show. I mean, we just closed down Traybert Street, Traybert Avenue. It was a quarter mile straight up a hill, then straight down a hill. It was really hard, but people loved it. And pretty quickly went to, what I did was I was like, look, I love drinking craft beer. And so I want to partner with breweries that I like their beer. Just follow my passion. So we went very quickly to Tampa and partner with Cigar City Brewing. Mm-hmm. Then we went to Texas and partnered with a great brewery there. And the event in Tampa had like 800 people.
Wow.
And then the event in Texas had 2,600 people. And we were so not equipped to deal with that amount of people all needing a cold beer at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, we were doing them at big facilities now. But the growth was really quick and there was no one else out there doing it. So it was suddenly what happened was there was a gentleman, I think his name is James Nielsen, who broke the 5-minute barrier in the beer mile.
Yeah. I remember this guy got a lot of press.
He did.
Right?
He was on ESPN all the time. He was on SportsCenter. The YouTube clip got like 7 or 10 million views. And suddenly people were looking for a beer mile. We were the only beer mile, the only one. The only other way you could do it was if you were, you know, at the end of a track season with your track buddies. So you could sneak out and do it on a high school track, or you could pay for us to have a band and put all the bells and whistles around it. So we had a great run of like a year and a half where people were looking to do this event and did, you know, 19 of them across the country.
Wow.
And look, it was a really great experience for me learning, scaling up, needing to order goods from China and procurement of medals and t-shirts in the 50,000 range, right? You're doing events for 3,000 people at a time. You're ordering huge goods and huge procurement. So I was able to learn so much about logistics, procurement. I had to hire people, right? It was I learned much more about marketing and digital marketing and the power of brands. So I learned a lot during that period. I also learned that I don't want to be away from my family that much. I didn't want to be getting 3,000, 4,000 people drunk every weekend because that's ended up what it ended up being was a party. And it wasn't fulfilling a desire I had to create something really special and lasting like the decathlon. The decathlon was great because people remember that event for a long time and the competitors remember the impact they had on the hospital. The beer mile was a fun Friday night.
Yeah.
You know, and we called it Beer Fit was our name. We still owned the Brew Mile, but stopped producing them at the end of last year because it just didn't feel like it was something that I wanted to be doing and associating myself with.
So, you know, what's interesting from a strength standpoint for you, right? Like what I see is like one of your top attributes throughout your journey from like childhood to this point, you're very aware of when you don't want to be doing something and making the change.
Sure.
And I feel like a lot of people aren't as either they're not as aware or they are, but they're not willing to get out of their comfort zone.
Yeah, look, that's an interesting insight. And I appreciate that. I'll tell you, it was very apparent that I didn't want to be doing it. But if it had been making $10 million a year, I'd still be doing it, right?
Okay.
And so, you know, as an entrepreneur, you're going to have a lot of people that always say, like, I've never had a failure. The business wasn't kicking ass in its second year. The first year, we, like, didn't know what to do with the growth. And the second year, you also realize, too, even when it was doing well, I lived in fear of someone getting in an accident drunk driving on the way home. Like, I just carried so much anxiety. I'm not an anxious person. And so, while I did know I didn't want to do it, the way in which of say exiting that business, you know, making good on all of our events and finishing out the season properly, doing it gracefully and taking care of people and taking care of your employees, I was very intentional about, but it doesn't make it easy, right?
Yeah.
And so I think, I knew I wanted to stop. I knew that it wasn't going to work anymore. For me, the business model didn't make sense in the long term. So I knew that it needed to end, but that doesn't mean it's easy. So I think for people listening, you know, it's one thing to know, hey, I need to stop doing this and make that change. But I'm not going to tell you that last fall wasn't the hardest period of my life. It wasn't fun letting staff go.
Yeah.
Right. That was really hard. It's the first time I've ever had to do it. It wasn't fun telling partners that big contracts I had with us that we were not going to renew. People couldn't understand because they thought that the event was doing so well. And in one market would do well, one market wouldn't do well. But, you know, that transition was not easy.
Yeah. I mean, especially when staff comes into play and you're dealing with those. I mean, you know, you're responsible for other people in a lot of ways. So understandable why you would have some anxiety
towards care. Them. You know, I really cared about those people. And I wanted to make sure that I could do everything I can to help them with what they were doing next.
So now you exit out of this and kind of back to square one, right? You know what you don't want to do,
exactly.
Right? Do you know what you do want to do now at this point?
You know, there were a few months of talking to a lot of really smart people and saying, I'm 35, 36 years old. What do I want to do with my life?
Yeah.
Like, I know I still want to create, but it was going to people who would say like, well, here's what I think your strengths are. Here's what I think you should do. And it was a really interesting time of realizing like what an amazing network of people I had around me who, would have hired me to do a lot of different jobs. I wasn't looking for a job. I'd been on my own for a bit, and I knew I wanted to create and do something again. I didn't know exactly what that was, and had formed a friendship through sports. My oldest had played football with my current business partner, his oldest named Laser, and they were friends. And you know, there was a practice that I had run to, and Jesse had said to me, Laser's dad, like, what are you doing? I was like, well, I want to get in my run, and I don't have time in my day. So like, I run to practice, I coach the team, and then I'll run home, and my wife will drive me each way, but this way I get my workout in. He was like, what do you do? And, you know, I kind of told him, and it sparked an interesting relationship where over the course of months, we kind of just talked about different things. At one point he said to me, hey, like, I want my own race series. Jesse's, you know, the penultimate entrepreneur, right? Started Marquee Jets, was a lead investor in Zico Coconut Water, and had it on his record label and sold it. He's done all these really cool things, and is an endurance athlete. And I knew I wanted, and I had a lot of events in my head that I wanted to be bigger. And we just started tossing around ideas, and that literally led us to the place where I'm at now, you know, working for Jesse full-time, creating events with him. And being very, once again, I think probably the common word through this podcast, being very intentional about what we wanted out of it. We literally sat in a room and wrote down on a whiteboard things that we wanted out of a weekend that had an endurance event be part of it.
And then that leads to the current event that you just did this past, what was it,
October? Yeah.
Which I took part in. And
not only took part in, kicked ass in.
Well, yeah. Listen, like yourself, I'll be very... The fact that I finished it, I was happy, but it was definitely, I would say, the hardest, most difficult, challenging event I've ever partook in. However, the most rewarding. And I think that's kind of one of the big takeaways of the event is how brutal it is as far as, you know, mentally and physically, but also how much clarity it gives you of what you're possible of doing as a human. So do you want to kind of touch on this event, this race, which, by the way, is 29029, and expand upon it?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, look, it's so awesome to hear you say what you got out of the event, because that's what we wanted to give people. I did an Ironman in August. I pushed a quadriplegic in a wheelchair in October. I've done hard things in races, but it takes a long time to get your body ready to do those types of events. And a lot of people aren't willing or not wanting to, or quite frankly, don't have a flexible enough schedule to allow them to train to do an Ironman or to do a really hard event like that. We wanted to create an event that allow people to take what they're normally doing, train up for it a little bit, but experience something super hard and put themselves in a position where they're going to have a choice of, do I continue or do I stop? And that's really hard to get to for a lot of people, because if you do a marathon, you're not going to stop. You know, 98% of people finish. It's not long enough. Doesn't mean it's not hard. It's super hard, but it's not long enough to get you to a place where you really have to consider a lot of things in your life. And 29 to 29, at the end of the day, it's an endurance hiking challenge. The idea is that no one focuses on vertical feet. And so when Jesse and I were doing runs and doing things, I'd always check my Garmin to see how many vertical feet I gained when I did a trail run. And I was shocked, like I only climbed 800 feet. Like, I wonder how hard it would be to get like 10,000 feet. I wonder how hard it'd be to get 20. Like, how many miles would I have to cover? And that transformed into, let's create in a weekend and an event and an experience around gaining vertical feet. And so the event morphed into something much bigger, as things do with Jesse, having a much broader vision of saying, look, we don't want it to just to be a challenge. We want to create a community. We want people to really get to bond over something. And so we're going to have many components to it. So that meant sleeping in a glamping tent outside and including all food and beverage. But at the end of the day, it's about the challenge. And the challenge is simply walking up a private ski mountain, really steep, unbelievably steep.
Really steep.
And, you know, think about covering 1,750 vertical feet. Tallest building in the United States, covering that amount of feet and only going a little over a mile, taking the gondola down and repeating that. And you had to do it 17 times on the same trail over about 36 hours to be able to finish, of which Justin did. And really separated people, not from a physical standpoint, totally mental. Once you got to that exhaustion standpoint that everyone got to, it was the mental that really made the difference.
And then can you kind of give people the significance of what the name represents?
Sure. So 29029 is 29,029 feet, which is the vertical height of Everest relative to sea level. So the event was going from zero sea level to 29,029 feet. And the best way I can put it in perspective is the next time you're on an airplane And the captain says, we've reached our cruising altitude. Think how long it took the airplane to get to that altitude. That's about 15 to 20 minutes for a commercial airline to get to cruising altitude. And then look out the window and then think about climbing there on steps yourself. And that's what someone like Justin did and the others that were at the event.
Would you say it like that? I would have never done it if I knew it was that. But so it's in Mount Stratton, right?
Yeah, it's at Stratton Mountain in Vermont.
I was going to say, so how many participants were there this year?
So we sold it out the first year at 150 people.
Okay.
And it was really important with that event, doing it the first time, to make sure we got as many aspects right as possible, and also wanting to be very thoughtful about creating a community and not letting it be too big, quite frankly. That was a big piece of it.
I mean, I'll definitely say, you know, and this is not because you're here. I've told you this off the show. For a first-year event, hearing your story and kind of what you've gone through from a logistics standpoint and understanding like putting on events and creating things makes sense now why everybody commented that it was a flawless first year event. For the large scale and magnitude of what you guys did, from people from transportation to tents to gondolas to food, I mean, it was really flawless. So it makes a lot more sense how you did it, because I mean, for those that, you know, you can go online. I'm sure there's things that people have posted and people could see. But, I mean, you got people that are running through the night till 3, 4, 5 a.m. in the morning in 30 degrees, wind coming with SUVs taking you down. And it, literally everyone had a smile on their face. Everybody literally was just loving life. As crazy as that sounds for running this type of competition. But how many people out of the 150 completed the 17? And then I only say that because for those that didn't, I want to still talk about how big of an accomplishment it was when you look at what they actually achieved from other scalability verticals.
Oh, yeah. It really impressive accomplishments by everyone who was there. First off, thanks for what you said. I can tell you we had a phenomenal team, and everyone was really excited about the weekend, from my staff to our partners at Stratton, and everyone we worked together. And I think we fed off the energy, quite frankly. We fed off the energy of the competitors who were really gutting themselves out because we knew how hard it was. I don't think everyone on the staff knew how hard it was until they actually walked them out once. They're like, oh, God, you got to do this 16
after my
more
first
times.
One, I realized, what did I get myself into?
So, you know, we had a 58% finisher rate. That's really tough.
Which is, by the way, much higher than I thought it would have been.
Yeah. And that, I think it's a testament to just how much people can go further than they think they're capable of. Jesse always says you're under indexing yourself, right? And I think a lot of people do that all too often. And we had people finish who'd never done a 5K. We also had people who'd finished an Ironman, not finish. And I think that really helps put it in perspective just around how much you have to check in mentally and stay present and only think about the 3 seconds that just happened, the three that are happening now, and the three in front of you. And if you're able to stay just in the moment over the course of 25 hours of really hard, intense exercise, then you're able to finish. Those that started thinking about the enormity of how much they had left, or, well, maybe I can rest now and I can go get it later. It really became a math problem for people. And I would say a lot of the people that didn't finish wasn't because of physical abilities. It wasn't because they were not mentally tough enough. They didn't really think through how the weekend was going to go, and they didn't put enough time on the hill early in the weekend. And that's something we're fixing for next year, just in not making – it's not adding more time, but it's being a little bit more thoughtful around doing it straight through.
Yeah.
Rather than having breaks where the mountains close and then you get back on, because we thought people would want to break it up into days. And at the end of the day, it's better to go through until you can't go anymore, sleep, and then finish again.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it also comes into play what you said back in your college days too, right? Is I think endurance is one thing, but I think a lot of people were also looking at others probably more than they should just be looking at themselves and the goal ahead of them. Because when you're seeing this person's at this number and this person's at that, not just human nature, you're going to get discouraged in some cases. Because, you know, I did day one and I went till 1:30 in the morning. I started at 2:30 on Friday, finished at 1:30 in the morning, and I only had 7 done. But you realize only after how much 7 actually is.
It's a ton.
So I think it's the educational aspect. But there was a thing that Jesse had said one night at the dinner, which I thought kind of like resonated with everybody in the room, which was, even if you didn't do all 17, the other levels, 5 hills, 6 hills, 7 hills, were still scaling some of the highest summits in the country.
Yeah, we had people who, you know, we had this amazing participant-only dinner to get together as a community Saturday night before the last day. And look, there's people who are discouraged who are like, look, I've only done seven. And only seven's incredible.
Incredible.
People who work at the mountain, you know, will say like doing two in a day is a lot. And you had people who'd done seven in a day who are saying there's no way I can finish tomorrow. And Jesse gave a speech where he just hit on it perfectly with saying, look, if you've done seven, you've already climbed the highest mountain in let's say North America, right? If you've done 10, you've already climbed the highest mountain in South America. If you've done 12, you've already climbed Kilimanjaro, right? And you start putting it in perspective of, wow, like I have accomplished a lot and I'm going to go from the highest mountain in Europe to the highest mountain in Africa tomorrow. You know, I'm going to go from Mount Elbrus to Kilimanjaro. And that's the reason I'm going to go out and climb tomorrow.
Yeah.
And everyone, I think, came out of there with a renewed kind of vigor for, look, yeah, this is a binary event. You finish or you don't. There is no first place medal. There's no age group awards. There's no fastest finisher. At the same time, it's not a failure if you did 12 or 14. It's a huge accomplishment, especially when people, that first hike, if you would have asked them how many they thought they could do after hike number one, a lot of those people would have told you six and they did 12.
Yeah.
So I think you have to compare yourself to what you thought was possible and then what you achieved at the end.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the other thing to kind of touch on is the age ranges and the different amounts of people that are running it. This isn't something where you're just like seeing, you know, triathletes or people that are crazy insane shape. You're seeing all walks of life. You're seeing 21-year-old kids. You're seeing 60-year-old people. You're seeing men, women, different skill. I mean, it was insane. And some that you would think not finished were the ones that crushed it and vice versa. And I think it all comes down to also a lot of mental capacity. And like you said, I probably wanted to quit every other one. And then you just literally have to, like you said, I like the 3-second rule that you're talking about, the three steps. You just literally have to go into your own. It's you against you, which is what I loved about the race. And I think for a lot of people, once they got into that groove, it was like, okay, it was life-changing for most people. I mean, I think a lot of people, they finished, they were crying. People got emotional. And I think that's when you know you have a good product, right? Forget medals, forget, you know, times. Just putting something in front of you that most people would think they never could do and then see what they're truly made of.
You never know when you create something like this if it's going to work. And so there's an excitement that goes into doing it. You know, Jesse and I tested this in North Georgia. And, you know, it was going up a mountain, 2,200 feet up. And having a gentleman that works for Jesse drive us down in a car and do it again and again and again. And so we knew how hard it was going to be, but we didn't know if people would enjoy it, if there would be that release. And, you know, I stood at the top of the mountain and was high-fiving every finisher, congratulating people each on just each summit attempt, right? Not just the finishers, just each person that made it to the top of each lap. And what I noticed was that as people were finishing, there was such a sense of accomplishment from people. And people were surprised the way they felt emotionally. I mean, I had women and men cry on my shoulder telling me, I don't know why I'm crying. But I got it, because when I finished my first Ironman, I cried.
Yeah.
And it was just such a release of all these months of effort. I think with 29 on 29, it was 30 hours, 28 hours of intense effort of staying in the moment, not thinking anything else, and then being like, oh my God, I'm done.
Yeah.
Like, I did it. And I think there's just such a sense of pride and just sheer joy that we saw out of people. I don't think it was relief that it was over. It was more... Yeah. A celebration of what had just happened. And, you know, for people that are listening, you know, each lap we celebrated by taking an amazing logo that we have. And we had a cattle brand that you branded it into a board of white oak. And we wanted it to be very tangible. We wanted it to be visceral. So you would smell the smoke and you would see it get burned in, because each lap was so hard and earned. And then when people finished, we gave you a flag and you planted your flag at the summit. And it was just to say, like, you've really conquered your own mountain. And you don't know how those things will go. I mean, you think of them, you know, in a whiteboard session or over a beer, and you're like, wow, is that hokey? Is that going to be cool? And to see that actually transpire and people wrap their flag around themselves and hold it tight, that was really, really special to see. And that was the biggest reward for me in the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I will say, the branding aspect, everybody loved it. You know, I would say these races or these challenges, this first one that you all put together, is really a challenge for your soul. Like, people are emotionally touched by these races, which I think is awesome, right? A lot of these other challenges, nothing against them, but they're more like accolades, right? What can I put around my neck? What, this is really a gut check. And I think that's what was amazing to see everybody kind of do. And I mean, same way, we'll take it back. When you did the decathlon, you saw somebody wearing a hat or a shirt and you're like, wow, the impact. It's insane to see how much people represent the 29029 gear. And I'll just be around Atlanta. And I was at Starbucks the other day and some guy is wearing his hat. I'm like, oh, did you do the race? He's like, yeah, you too. The sense of pride that people have, I think you nailed it when you said community. Yeah. And that's really what it's built is. And now this community, unfortunately, has led me and you to running a 100-mile ultra in August, but we won't talk about that. But I think, you know, it's amazing what you guys have done. So what's kind of the next step? Are you going to redo the race? Is it going to happen next year? What are kind of plans?
Sure. You know, when we sat down and talked about building this business, it was creating a series of these events. And I think we came out of the gate and we have a winner in this event. It was phenomenal in the sense of community that was created, people who finished and want to do it again, people who did not finish and want to come back and get that last one, but people who are looking for the next challenge. I'm a guy who has exercise ADD, right? I did an Ironman once, I'm done. I want to do the next thing. And there's a lot of people who are like that as well, who are looking for the next event. So we're creators, so we're working on other events, but we also see how many aspects of this challenge work. And the reason this challenge works so well is each hike up the mountain was an opportunity to walk with someone else. It's an hour hike. That's not to downplay how hard it is, but while it's really hard, you're still talking like you and I can talk. There are some sections where it gets a little tougher and you can't talk, right? You're bent over. But a gondola car ride down, there's an opportunity to bond and connect with people, which is very strong. So for next year, you know, we are doing 29029 again. It'll be at Stratton October 11th through 14th. And tickets go on sale December 12th. So tickets go on sale in 2 weeks from now. So we expect to sell that out again very quickly. But also look to expand our footprint a little bit. These events, we want to keep highly curated, small, that sense of community. But going out west and doing an event at altitude around a similar theme in different mountain is something that we're working on. We have a whole host of ideas around events that are not related to endurance hiking that we'll hopefully roll out one of those next year. So I think a common theme for us in events is really getting people outside of their comfort space, getting them outside as much as we can, getting them away from their device and having them connect with others, and then having it be thoughtless. It's one price, arrive, all food and beverage accommodations taken care of, all your food, hydration, all those little details that are we're going through right now for we're doing the Leadville 100 trail run next year. And you have to think about all of these aspects, and it's a lot of planning. Buy your ticket, show up, know you're going to be in an amazing community of like-minded people, and you're going to face some really hard challenges. I think that's the thing, is that the challenges themselves need to be surprising, need to be hard to prepare for, but doable without a lifestyle change. So there's a lot of components to it, but at the end of the day, it's really don't change your lifestyle, but expect to be changed coming out of the event.
Gotcha. So for those that want to look at the race for next year, want to participate, where do they go? Where do they get that information?
Yeah, exactly. So it's 29029.com is the best place to check out all the information about the event. You know, sign up on our mailing list. We'll get you a lot of the great information. And then from there, as we release other events, we'll leverage it from that platform.
All right, cool. Well, you know, I appreciate you coming on today. Appreciate kind of hearing the story, what you have working on. You know, if you can leave people with the one thing today, right, as far as your journey that's led you to this point, what do you think has kind of been your mentality, your mantra, your thought process to kind of lead you to where you are now with this intentional life that you've kind of dictated?
Do things you're scared of. And I know maybe a lot of people will say that, few will act on it. I signed up for an Ironman because I was honestly kind of scared of swimming, and it forced me to swim 2.4 miles in the open water. And, when you do things you're scared of, a lot of people will feed off of that. And so you don't always have to present yourself as being fearless, right? It's facing that. And what my kids got to see from me being very intentional about creating an event, doing an Ironman, pushing a quadriplegic in a wheelchair for a marathon, those types of things really scared me. I didn't know what the outcome was going to be. I didn't know what the outcome of 29-29 was going to be. I really didn't know if people were going to like it or not. But if you make yourself vulnerable by doing something that you're scared of, whether it be in sports, athletics, in your relationship, if that's being open with your spouse about things that you're scared of or challenges you're facing, or if it's an event like 29-29, if you put yourself in that position, you are guaranteed to learn something about yourself and how self-discovery, and there's not enough opportunities for people to do that. So take advantage of those opportunities because they'll really impact you for the rest of your life.
Amazing, man. Well, I appreciate you coming on today.
Thanks for having
Excited
me.
For people it's to hear great. This. Definitely, yeah. man. And Cheers. Looking forward to running 100 with you.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm looking forward to, I'm looking forward to finishing with you. How about that?
Sounds good,
yeah,
man.
Cheers. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Once again, I'm your host, Justin Epstein, and thank you for listening to Culturation. As always, this show has been powered by Premiere.